WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Michelle Franzen. Police in Utah say the suspect is not in custody yet following today's fatal shooting of Charlie Kirk. It conflicts with an earlier post from FBI Director Kash Patel saying that a suspect has been taken into custody. The founder of the conservative group Turning Point USA was speaking at an outdoor event at Utah Valley University today.
The shooting happened before a crowd of hundreds on the campus of Utah Valley University, where Charlie Kirk was kicking off a fall tour of college campuses. Kirk's on-campus events would feature him engaging with members of the audience who often espoused views contrary to his. It was during a back and forth on mass shootings allegedly committed by transgender people that the shooting occurred. The bullet struck the 31-year-old near his throat. Kirk's security team quickly swept in and carried him away. Stephen Portnoy, ABC News.
President Trump ordered flags at half-staff through Sunday. Both Republicans and Democrats have denounced the killing and latest political violence. This is ABC News.
Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
For 98.3 and 96.5 WISS News, I'm Shally Pittman, filling in for Lisa Hale. The town of Black Wolf is moving forward with the new ambulance provider, along with several other communities. The decision will shift coverage from the Oshkosh Fire Department to LifeStar Ambulance next year. It's according to reporting from Fox 11. That's despite concerns raised by the Van Dyne Fire Department, which had encouraged residents to attend the recent town board meeting, citing concerns over longer EMS response times, reduced paramedic staffing, and a lack of clarity on the station's locations. Under the new agreement, LifeStar will serve the area as part of a newly formed ambulance district, which officials say offers more control and a lower cost to taxpayers. Some officials have said the change became necessary after a proposed cost increase from Oshkosh. Meanwhile, facing a growing structural deficit, Winnebago County is looking at the possibility of adding a sales tax. Winnebago and Waukesha are the only two counties in Wisconsin that don't have a local sales tax. State law allows counties to add a 0.5 sales tax on top of the state's 5% rate. The item will come back to the county board next Tuesday, when supervisors are expected to take up a resolution that would direct county attorneys to draft a sales and use tax ordinance. This wouldn't implement the tax yet. It's just the first step. The ordinance itself is expected to be considered at a county board meeting in November. According to a draft resolution, the tax would give the county more financial flexibility and help support services. It also notes that local municipalities have voiced concerns about keeping up with rising costs. Under the draft plan, they'd get a share of the revenue too. I'm Shally Pittman for 98.3 and 96.5 WISS News.
The Brewers lose in Texas. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers lost to the Texas Rangers today, 6-3. The Rangers completing a sweep of the Crew. The last time the Brewers were swept in a three-game series was opening weekend in March in New York against the Yankees. The Brewers had 11 hits but could only manage to score three runs. They have tomorrow off and host the Cardinals Friday night. NFL. Packers making an interesting move, signing wide receiver Christian Watson to a one-year contract extension worth over $13 million. Watson rehabbing that torn ACL he suffered January 5th against the Bears.
I mean, I don't have a timeline as of right now. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, get back to feeling 100%, doing, you know, everything I need to do out there, and then I'll kind of just let the trainers and everything, you know, let me out. I mean, it's been feeling really good so far. I haven't, you know, had anything, you know, to deal with so far. It's all just been, you know, feeling really good. I'm able to just keep on going out there and attacking my rehab, and oh yeah, it's been going real good.
That's the Packers' Christian Watson with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the mid-50s with patchy fog tomorrow morning, then turning mostly sunny, warm for tomorrow afternoon, high in the mid-70s. 80s for the rest of the week and weekend. A slight chance of rain Friday night on into Saturday. It's 69 degrees right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
James Santel joining me. Donald Trump just flat out threatening Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
A lot of people apparently, Maggie, in high places in government engaging in mortgage fraud, including Adam Schiff and Letitia James, and now Commissioner Cook as well. The Federal Reserve is created independent of politics, preventing exactly this kind of thing from happening. This is the instability that causes economic crisis.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
Louisiana versus Calais, C-A-L-L-A-I-S, could deal a death blow to the impact, the power, the capacity of the Supreme Court to decide Voting Rights Act cases. This is one of those times when the Supreme Court needs to hear from the public about the appropriate resolution of this major case that could compromise the Voting Rights Act going forward beyond Louisiana.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11. Maggie Dawn.
I've got a little personal business to attend to, but don't worry. We've got a special re-airing of Girls Rock and then a best of curated just for you.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
Finally, a voice for real news and great conversation in the Fox Valley, WISS.
To make things right, to make people happy tonight.
It is.
Can we do that?
I think so.
Are you happy?
Yep.
Are you a happy person in general?
Yeah.
Or do you just put on a happy face when you're here? Do you leave every night, you leave the studio and just you're just a miserable person?
No.
I don't think so. I didn't get that from you.
Okay. That's
all right. Very good. So, did you have a good day?
Yeah. Got a nice haircut.
You did. You know what I'm going to say? It's a haircut you can set your watch by.
You know, I always go in there and I say, you know, just keep it high and tight.
High and tight, baby. I'm due for a high and tight. I got probably next week I'll get in the chair.
High and tight?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I don't know. You know, I think I told you this. I used to, every summer I would shave my head because it felt so great.
When was that?
That was like, I mean, going back to the mid-2000s. My job at Sports Soup, when I was a staff writer and performer on the show, and I had my buddy KP Anderson hired me. I was the last writer hired. And I showed up, and all the other writers had already been situated, and I walk in with my head shaved, and one guy told me 3 months later, I thought you were going to kill us. I guess I look that scary. I think I have a nice face, a friendly face, but apparently, you know, in like 2014, I shaved my head, and Mary Picorni Donlin, who has been on this show before, the producer of some of the shows I do on PBS Wisconsin, said, please tell me that's going to grow out before we record. Like, I don't know what it is. It feels great, but it puts you in a category where people think you're either an ex-con, a white supremacist, or some kind of crazy, I don't know what it is, but it feels great. When you shave your head, it feels amazing. It's liberating.
I've never shaved my head.
Dude, you gotta.
I'm good.
Why? What do you, and I don't mean to like put, hold your feet to the fire here, Con, but like, what are you losing by shaving your, other than your hair? What are you?
I really like my hair. That's the thing.
Yeah. You got good hair.
It grows back though. I never want to like lose it, you know?
Cause here's what would happen.
There's a thing where it could happen.
Good evening, and welcome to Civic Media's coverage of the Cap Times 2025 Idea Fest. Tonight, live from UW-Madison's Memorial Union, we will hear conversations with writer and editor Garrett Graff and Governor Tony Evers, both moderated by David Moranis. At 7 o'clock, following Graff's remarks, Pat Kreitlow of Mornings with Pat Kreitlow will join us for some Idea Fest recap and analysis. And then, at 7:30, Governor Evers will take the stage. We go now live to Memorial Union for Cap Times Idea Fest.
See you out again tonight. Welcome to the third evening of the ninth annual Cap Times Idea Fest. I'm Paul Fanlon, publisher of the Capital Times, and I'd like to welcome each and every one of you for being here tonight. I've told people over the last couple of nights, it means the world to us to get the kind of attendance, record attendance we have this year. And how it supports the locally owned and managed Capital Times. If you're not already a member, many of you are, I know, please consider becoming one. In times to come, we plan to do some members-only events, and so that's another reason to consider joining us. That'll be outside the scope of the Idea Fest week. I want to direct your attention briefly to the listed sponsors on the boards behind me. They together, plus your support, make this fabulous event possible. So thank you. Our programs this week have felt remarkably timely, given what's going on in the country, and this one is no exception. Journalist and author Garrett Graff is the former editor of both Politico and Washingtonian magazines. He's also an instructor at Georgetown University. He writes an online newsletter titled Doomsday Scenario. David Moranis, tonight's moderator, describes it as perhaps the most pungent analysis of the current political landscape out there. Garrett describes his newsletter as a mix of national security, politics, and history that attempts to answer the question, are things really as bad as they seem? He attracted much notice recently with a post suggesting how the country may have just recently tipped into authoritarianism in the last few weeks. He wrote in part, "It's clear today America is different, and even if we fight our way back, it will never be the same again." Garrett's newest book was released last month to great acclaim. It's titled, "The Devil Reached for the Sky, An Oral History of the Making and Unleashing of the Atomic Bomb." His books are for sale. That book in particular is for sale back in the lobby, and he'll be available after to autograph copies. I'm looking forward to reading it. I've read reviews, and they're terrific. In it, he draws on the voices of some 500 people who either witnessed or participated in the Manhattan Project or the later bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Garrett is clearly among America's most important next generation of political thinkers. We are thrilled that David Moranis invited him to Madison tonight and that he accepted. Please give a warm Madison welcome to Garrett Graff and David Moranis. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. So Garrett was kind of the boy wonder of Washington, who bailed for his home state of Vermont, something I can relate to. He claims that Vermont cheese is superior, but he can run, but you can't hide, right? You go to Vermont, but what do? You write a blog about Washington. Sort of. And it's one that I read avidly, even when it raises my blood pressure to a dangerous degree. But I've thought of Garrett in another sense. My favorite political writer of all time was George Orwell. And the reason was that not only was he rational and confident and able to relate his own sensibility in a way that transcended ideology, but it was so clear. And he could write, as he would put it, about what is in front of your nose, but you don't see until he writes it. And I think of Garrett that way as sort of a young Orwell, which is the most I could say about someone. So, or at least a budding Orwell. But doomsday scenario, man. Welcome to Madison, Dr. Doom. and I just really, you just said backstage about that title and what it was, you thought it might convey and what it came to convey. What was it, what were you originally thinking of, doomsday scenario?
Thank you, David, for having me in those overly generous introductory words there. It's a pleasure to be here in Madison. One of the really fun things about being on a book tour is the chance to get out and see a lot of thriving independent bookstores around the country. And it's fun here in Madison to see a thriving local media organization from the standpoint that there are not very many of them that are as central to a community's fabric as Cap Times is here for Madison. So my newsletter was supposed to be more fun than it has turned out to be. I wrote a book in 2017 that was called Raven Rock. That is, the subtitle of the book is the story of the U.S. government's plan to save itself while the rest of us die. And it was the history of the U.S. government's continuity of government operations, all of the sort of weird things that would happen during and after nuclear war, during the Cold War, sort of all of the history of presidential succession and all of those weird subjects. You probably, some of you in the audience remember the, you know, Bert the Turtle and the duck and cover drills of the elementary school in the 50s and 60s. And so the newsletter originally grew out of that and sort of this idea that a lot of what I write about is, you know, sort of doomsday scenario planning and thinking about some of the worst things in the world that could happen. But it was originally launched several years ago with a much more tongue-in-cheek idea that the answer was supposed to be that things are not as bad as they seem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to the real doomsday, as opposed to the doomsday we're facing now, but let's talk about that one first. I was really struck by something you wrote recently about ICE. We've all seen sort of on video clips the brutality of ICE, which is horrible. But what Garrett was able to document was the totality of ICE and how it truly has become a paramilitary or military organization, the brown shirts of the Trump administration. Can you talk about what you saw, where they're taking people, and what it's developed into?
Sure. So I've spent a lot of my journalism career actually writing about federal law enforcement. And I've written a history of, I've written actually a couple of books on the FBI. I spent several years at Politico covering the wave of criminality and corruption in Customs and Border Protection and the Border Patrol that overtook that agency in the wake of its own post 9/11 hiring surge. In something that will sound semi-familiar to anyone who is following what is going on with ICE right now, after 9/11, in the sort of late Bush years, the Border Patrol tried to double and triple in size in a very short period of time. And the answer is that there is no healthy way for a law enforcement agency to grow that quickly at that scale. And what ended up happening was the Border Patrol cut its training standards, it cut its hiring standards, it pushed agents out into the field before they had been fully trained. And one of the ways that hiring surges break organizations is what it also means is that people are pushed up into supervisory and executive ranks before they are ready and before they are experienced. And so what that meant at the Border Patrol and CBP, which is the parent agency that makes up both the blue uniformed Office of Field Operations that make up the people that you see at official ports of entry, as well as the green uniforms of the Border Patrol, that from over a 7-year period at the end of Bush through the early years of Obama, there were 2,170 Border Patrol agents and CBP officers arrested themselves for misconduct, crime, and corruption. And what that meant is that for that 7-year period, during the period that they were working, that during that period, there was one, I forget the exact years, but it was sort of roughly 2008 to 2015. During that period, there was one CBP officer or Border Patrol agent arrested every single day for 7 years. And one would think that that was a lesson that DHS would have learned. And we are now actually trying to speed run that hiring surge in all of the same ways with ICE today as they race to add 10,000 new officers that were funded as part of the Republican spending bill this summer that will sort of turbocharge immigration enforcement in the United States. And ICE is already repeating all of the same set of mistakes that the Border Patrol made in the Bush and Obama years, including that they have already cut their training length, which was already among the shortest of all federal law enforcement agencies. And they are now setting up a training regimen that is just 47 days long to become an ICE officer, as compared to the 5 or 6 months, for instance, that it takes to become an FBI special agent. 47, of course, chosen not because it has a particular educational level that it obtains, but because it is, of course, the number of the president that Donald Trump is. And you know you are setting an agency up to fail when you are setting its training standards as part of some cult of personality.
One can only imagine how many Proud Boys are going to get into this organization. But along with that, they're depleting other agencies to fill the void, right? And can you talk about where they're taking people from and how that's weakening so many other places?
Yeah, so one of the things that I was writing about this week was the extent to which everything is becoming ICE. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this weird melange of federal law enforcement agencies, but they each have their own distinct roles and responsibilities. You know, DEA, ATF, Secret Service, FBI, U.S. Marshals, Diplomatic Security Service, IRS criminal investigators. And basically all of these agencies are now being seconded to ICE to work immigration enforcement. And right now in the United States, it's roughly 1 out of 5 FBI agents is now working immigration enforcement, which means that we have actually reassigned more FBI agents to immigration enforcement than we reassigned to counterterrorism cases after 9/11. Half of all DEA agents are now working immigration enforcement, and two-thirds of all ATF agents are now actually working ICE immigration enforcement, including as well, you know, agents from diplomatic security services, IRS criminal investigations. And so I think one way to sort of look at what ICE is doing to us right now is that the federal government has made a very specific decision that it is going to stop investigating almost all federal crime in order to prioritize immigration enforcement. And so, you know, think of the cases that we are not working right now on counterintelligence, on cybercrime, on espionage, on counterterrorism, on domestic terrorism, on white-collar crime, human smuggling, human trafficking, drug smuggling, drug cartels, you know, just a huge, this is an amazing, amazing time to be a criminal in the United States.
Well, yeah, in the White House. Do you think that this will just, I mean, the 10,000 that they want to bring in, will they keep the other people too and just make it a sort of the police force of the United States?
It's sort of hard to tell, because I think one thing that we have seen is that they are effectively pausing all other federal law enforcement hiring through the end of the calendar year in order to do this ICE hiring surge. And I think that that has some big downstream implications in terms of people who are not going to be coming into some of these agencies and offices. But across the federal government right now, there are 33,000 people who do not work at ICE who have been reassigned to work for ICE and support their immigration enforcement. And if you add in state and local police officers who work on federal task forces, like a violent crimes task force or a joint terrorism task force, who have been reassigned, that's another 8,000, which gets you to around 42,000 people, all told, who did not work for ICE on immigration enforcement 3 months ago, who now are.
And then you have the actual military. A couple of months ago, I was in Austin, Texas, at the LBJ School on a panel with Admiral McRaven, who was literally shaking, talking about what's happening to the military and its politicization under Hegseth and Trump, and the way that they're using the military as a political force in this country. What do you see there, and can that be turned around, or is this a generational change in the military that's going to be very difficult to deal with?
So I think this is a problem both on the military side and on the federal law enforcement side, which is, I think Donald Trump's evil superpowers is the way that he makes those of us who believe in institutions defend institutions that deserve actual reform and criticism. And so what I'm about to say is not an endorsement of all of the behavior of all federal law enforcement across all of American history, but we all as American citizens have a really vested interest in the moral legitimacy of federal law enforcement. Much of our daily life is secured by the idea that most Americans and most businesses in America are inclined to cooperate when the FBI shows up and says, you know, hey, we've got a problem, you know, we need your help. Most of us are inclined to be helpful to federal law enforcement when we can be. And what I think we are watching right now is the administration torching the moral legitimacy and sort of goodwill that federal law enforcement has built up across America over decades. And again, not in every community, not, you know, these are not perfect records. I'm the first to, you know, criticize the FBI on various fronts. The idea that you have these communities, and, you know, we're watching this in Chicago, we're watching this in DC, we're watching this in communities all across the country, where, you know, you have people in the streets driving away, federal law enforcement operations, or jeering National Guard's troops as they patrol in Washington, D.C. That's not good for our country long term. The National Guard in particular is a unit where it is not designed to be a domestic police force, and that is not why people join the National Guard. And the extent to which it is being used as some sort of augmentation of domestic police forces is incredibly corrosive to the sort of fabric of a democratic and open society.
Many in the audience were here last night and heard Stacey Abrams, who was incredible, sort of articulating a 10-point road to autocracy. And Jen Rubin and Norm Eisen were also filling in a lot of that. You've written quite a bit about that. And in your mind, it's not that we're on the road, we're there. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think there's a... I think that there's a mistaken sense for a lot of people that there will be some bright line where sort of everything before this is democracy and everything after it is authoritarianism. And what I think we saw unfold in America over the month of August was our country tipping into something new. And what I mean by that is over the month of August, we saw the military occupation of our nation's capital. We saw the rise of these, ICE tactics of masked, anonymous agents of the state, leaping out of unmarked vehicles and kidnapping people based on the color of their skin. Which is now legal, according to the Supreme Court. We've seen sort of all of these weird moments. You know, President Trump taking a stake in intel for the U.S. government. You know, levying a presumably unconstitutional export tax on NVIDIA so it can export its AI chips. We saw Tim Cook from Apple show up in the Oval Office and literally hand the president gold on camera in order to curry personal favor so that his company could continue operating. We saw the president over the month of August, begin to interfere in our nation's history with the Smithsonian, in our culture. You know, this is a president who believes that he personally should get to choose what plays get performed on which stages. We saw him, and this is sort of the type of thing that like goes by very quickly, and yet I think actually are moments worth mentioning. He, on sort of a random Sunday afternoon, tweeted out how he decreed that Major League Baseball needed to induct Roger Clemens into the Hall of Fame immediately. And that sort of all of this is filtered through this sense that his is the one true taste, that sort of all of American culture and history, the books that we read, the plays that we watch, the sports that we watch, should be reflections of what he thinks is good. And that to me, is the picture of authoritarianism. And so what I tried to document was that sort of America today feels different, and today is different than before. And that doesn't mean that we are a fully authoritarian state. That doesn't mean that some of this is not reversible. But it does mean, to me, that America has crossed a fundamental line that we have never crossed before as a nation. And that regardless of the stories that we tell ourselves about our country and about ourselves as a people, we have crossed a line that we never thought could be crossed here in the United States. And David, let me sort of say one more thing. So I just finished this book that was in the introduction that was about the making of the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb. And the most chilling chapter so it's an oral history. It's all in the first person of the voices of the people who participated and lived it. And the chapter that was most chilling for me to work on I was working on it in January and February, and it was the chapter about the mostly Jewish refugee scientists who fled the enveloping cloak of Hitler's fascism to come to the United States across the 1930s and 1940, 1941. And it was their memories and stories of what it was like to watch fascism take over their country. And the way that will sort of forever puzzle, I think, historians and puzzled them at the time, the extent to which Germany didn't put up a fight as it lost its democracy. And you had all of these powerful people in Germany saying, and this I'm sure doesn't sound familiar at all, don't worry, we can control him. Once he gets into power, he's not going to be as bad as he says he's going to be, and we'll have good people around him who will control him. And they talked about their neighbors who... The physicist talks about how he was stopped by one of his neighbors on the street who had joined the Nazi party. He knew that this physicist was Jewish, and the sort of rising anti-Semitism was driving a lot of these physicists away. And his neighbor stopped him to sort of say, Don't worry, I don't really believe all this stuff, but it was just going to be better for my career if I joined the Nazi party rather than sort of stood up against it. And it's reading these quotes, it just feels incredibly chilling watching what we are living through right now.
I just happened to read a piece about the U.S. Open and Trump's going there, and the writer was watching this woman cheer loudly for Donald Trump, and then she explained that she's afraid she'd get deported if she didn't support him. So, I think that so many of us, or I should speak for myself, but I'm sure there are millions of people like me who over the last few years have felt like they were naive their whole lives, that they didn't think this could happen. Did you?
So I told this story actually in a column when I was writing about this sort of enveloping cloak of fascism here in the United States, where for me there was one very specific moment. I was in Washington in the 2008 financial crisis, and I was at one of those backgrounder luncheons that reporters have with newsmakers. You probably went to approximately 5,000 of them.
I avoided them.
In your own career. And we were up on the hill with Eric Cantor, who I think was deputy whip maybe at the time, but sort of rising star in the Republican Party at the time. And the House was considering whether to vote for that first big bailout. And this was the moment, you probably remember, John McCain had suspended his campaign. Sort of everyone was sort of focused on getting this bill through that was, you know, President Bush said was critical to the support of the economy. Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, John McCain, the Republican presidential nominee. Everyone said that this was necessary to save the American economy. And we were sitting in this luncheon, and Eric Cantor said, we're going to vote it down. And we were all incredulous, because we were like, everyone in your party, like, your party is in control, and your party says that this is critical. Like, how are you going to do this? And he was just like, no, we're going to vote it down, like, no bailouts for Wall Street. And that's what they did. As you remember, there was a day they voted down that first bailout. The stock market dropped 800 points. You know, it was this incredibly dark moment in that fall of 2008. And I walked out of that luncheon feeling like I had glimpsed, I remember it so vividly, that I had glimpsed this sort of level of nihilism in the sort of beating heart of what was coming to be the center of the Republican Party that really worried me. Because it was this moment where I was like, if you're not willing to do the thing that's good for the country, that sort of everyone agrees is good for the country, like, that's a level of politics that until, you know, you can argue about other examples, et cetera, et cetera. But that to me was sort of the first moment that I feel like I really saw that. And that I sort of long believed, probably longer than I should have, that there was going to be some red line that the Republican Party leadership would not trade for greed and power. And some principle somewhere that they actually believed in at their core. And I think we have now gotten to the point where we can sort of safely say that there is no principle that lies at the heart of the modern Republican Party that they will not trade for greed and power.
Garrett, you weren't even born for Watergate, were you?
No.
No. And yet, you're a student of it and looked at it with fresh eyes long after the fact. I'm curious about, I mean, I've read a lot of what you've written about it, but I'd like you to talk about sort of your perspective on it from history's perspective and from today and Nixon and Trump.
Yeah, so I wrote a history of Watergate that came out in 2021, I think, 2022. And it was inspired by my years of covering the first Trump administration. And I was interested in what happened the last time our U.S. system confronted a corrupt and criminal president in office. And Watergate we sort of shorthand as this burglary on June 17th, 1972 at the Democratic National Committee headquarters. But I think Watergate is best thought of as a mindset and not an event. And it's this sort of paranoid, conspiratorial worldview that Richard Nixon brings into the White House that then serves as an umbrella for about 13 different and distinct scandals, that of which the burglary is really only one of them. And what you saw, to me, Watergate is actually this incredibly inspiring moment in American politics, because you see the delicate ballet of checks and balances written into the Constitution that all come together to force this president from office. And you sort of every single part of the Washington structure has to work together and do its own part. And, you know, the press, the Justice Department, the FBI, the House, the Senate, the District Court, the Appeals Court, the Supreme Court, sort of Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, the Bill of Rights, sort of it's all written into the fabric of Watergate. And when you think about the difference between then and now, one of the things that really stands out to me is the extent to which the Republican members of Congress in Watergate understood that their constitutional oath required them to act as co-equal members of the legislative branch to hold the executive branch's abuses to account. And that their first duty was as members of Congress, and that only second were they Republican. And that Republicans actually play an incredibly important part in Watergate, from
as
Howard
they
Baker
did in the McCarthy era.
From Howard Baker to Lowell Weicker to others, and what they understood was that Congress needed to protect its own prerogatives, and that sort of they had their own role in the House and the Senate to play in ensuring that the presidency and the executive branch did not get sort of out of control, didn't get too much power. And to me, that's the single biggest difference that we have seen between then and now. And it's sort of one of the things that I think the founders didn't ever possibly appreciate was the idea that members of Congress would stand around and say, well, you know, all those laws that we passed, you know, it's totally fine if the president ignores them. You know, if he can do what he wants, he's the president.
One of the themes that I've written about and thought a lot about over the course of my career is whether human nature can change or whether the culture changes around it. So that leads to the question, are these Republicans from that era, were they better people? Were they wiser? Or was it the culture that was the difference?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think some of it is you have to, and you know, you've written a great book about this moment as well and the collapse of faith in American institutions that occurred against the backdrop of Nixon and the Pentagon Papers and Vietnam. But there was really a belief in institutions in that era that we have lost. You know, one of the sort of most remarkable aspects of the of what comes out of Watergate is this idea that presidents will lie to the American people, which was literally unthinkable at the start of Nixon's presidency.
But all presidents had lied before
that. All presidents have lied. But that you see even Democrats in the midst of Watergate saying, well, Nixon says he's not involved and he's the president. He wouldn't lie to us. You know, we can't impeach him. He's the president. And that's the Democrats.
Moving to the future, before we get into the past again, there were some interesting discussions last night about 2026, both whether that's the most important thing or not, whether there are other ways of dealing with autocracy that are equally important to that election. But do you think there will be an election?
Oh, absolutely. This has never been a question to me. Okay. Every country in the world effectively has elections. Yeah.
That's what Stacey said.
Russia has regular elections. Saddam Hussein had a undefeated record in Iraqi elections. You know, what I think my concern, And I think we're starting to see this in places like Texas. We're starting to see it in the deployment of the National Guard and ICE to American cities. Is the efforts by the Republican Party to lock in an illegitimate minority rule by selecting who gets to vote in 2026. That in a closely divided country, you don't actually have to change that many districts, that many votes, in order to really change the electoral map. And think of a election next fall in 2028 where they look exactly like every other election that we are used to in America, except just totally coincidentally, the National Guard is deployed to 10 major U.S. cities with minority-heavy voting populations, and those 10,000 new ICE officers just happened to set up a whole bunch of ID checkpoints, not at the polling places, but just sort of in the neighborhood of the polling places. Like, you don't have to have that many people stay home before you've really changed the electoral map.
Just a few hundred thousand can do it,
yeah.
And there's a million or thousands of little things that are happening like that, right? Yeah. Like.
And this, it's all part of, you know, Donald Trump's push to end mail-in voting. That matters in the scenario where you have to go through an ICE checkpoint in order to vote next year. Like, this, these are not disconnected. I think part of the challenge of Donald Trump is there's so much that happens on any given day that it's easy to not think that all of these dots end up connected in some way. But they all point in the same direction.
On a happier subject about nuclear war.
Yes, yes, bring it on.
Since you're on a book tour for The Devil Reached to the Sky, what prompted you to tackle that one?
So this is my third book-length volume of oral history. And I started with a book in 2019 that was an oral history of 9/11. It's a book called The Only Plane in the Sky. Tomorrow, of course, the 24th anniversary. The book came out for the 19th, or sorry, for in 2019 for the 18th anniversary, which to me was this really important moment where you began to see the first generation of Americans born after 9/11 coming into adulthood in a world shaped by 9/11, but who were too young to remember it. And the 9/11 that they know is the one that they read in history books. And the history that we tell of 9/11 goes like this. The attacks begin at 8:46 in the morning. The whole thing is over 102 minutes later at 10:28 with the collapse of the second tower. There are four planes, four attack sites, and 3,000 people die. And that is entirely factually true. But if any of you remember 9/11, that's not the day that you remember experiencing. We didn't know when the attacks began. We didn't know when the attacks were over. For most of the day, we didn't know how many hijacked planes there had been. Remember, as late as 1 o'clock Eastern time, the US government believed there were still a dozen hijacked airliners in the skies over North America. We also didn't think that these were attacks that were in any way confined only to New York, Washington, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You know, skyscrapers were evacuated across the country. Disneyland closed. It was only the second time in history Disney had ever actually closed. The Toronto subway was evacuated. I mean, there was a real sense throughout that day of fear, chaos, confusion, and trauma. And so if you only read about 9/11 in history books, you don't get that fear, chaos, confusion, and trauma. And if you don't understand the fear, the chaos, the confusion, and the trauma, you don't understand why America reacted in the way that we did. And to me, there's a power that uniquely comes in oral history that lets you experience these moments in the eyes of the people who lived them at moments where they didn't know the outcome. That I think I've written narrative history, you are a master of narrative history, but so much of the way that we tell history makes events seem neater, cleaner, simpler, and more preordained than they felt to anyone who lived them at the time. Look at this moment that we are living through right now. None of us know how this story ends. We don't know right now whether we're in the beginning, the middle, or the end of the story. And so from that 9/11 book, I wanted to go back to World War II because World War II is at the opposite end of that arc of history right now. You know, we've been experiencing these 80th anniversaries of the end of the war, including leading up to the last Tuesday and the 80th anniversary of the surrender ceremonies in Tokyo Bay. And I think they feel so poignant because we are also marking the unofficial passing of the greatest generation who fought and won those wars. And so from a historian's perspective, I was attracted to it because we have at this moment every first-person memory we are ever going to have of World War II. And to try to tell these stories, I started with a book on D-Day last year, and then this one on the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb, where to try to tell these stories through the eyes of the people who lived them before they knew how the stories would turn out. That sort of, what was it like to go to work on the Manhattan Project when you didn't know who was going to win World War II? The motivating factor for the start of the Manhattan Project is the idea that Adolf Hitler is building a bomb too. And you can't understand the Manhattan Project unless you understand how the pressure that those scientists felt that they were under from 1940 to 1944 was the idea that Adolf Hitler and Werner Heisenberg were at work at the same time on a bomb. And they didn't know whether Hitler was going to get the bomb first. They didn't know who was going to win. They didn't know whether the atom bomb would work at all. And trying, I think, to sort of understand that history and what it was like to experience those moments in the eyes and the voices and the footsteps of the people who lived them, I think is incredibly important both to understanding the past, but because it also, I think, helps us look at our current moment with fresh eyes, which is none of us know how this story turns out. And I think one of the things that telling these stories through oral history has helped me better recognize is that I think we over-index in our own sense of the future, that the future is going to look more like the past than it has to. And that we sort of, I think, wrongly, and I think this is one of the things that the press corps gets really wrong about this moment right now, is the idea that America's future will sort of be within a standard deviation or two of what America's past has been. And there is no guarantee of that. And that, to me, there's a real power that comes in going back and looking at these voices that helps better shape how we have to consider what our own future is going to be.
We'll get to the press very soon. I just want to ask one more question about oral history. I imagine that what you do with oral history and what I do to write a narrative history, we do the same sort of research. But what did you go through to compile this oral history of the bomb?
Yeah, so I do, I'm a Vermonter, home of the world's best Cabot cheese. One of the things that I sort of always talk about in oral history is like making maple syrup. That it is a very slow, long boil. And it is the opposite of normal writing because it's all subtractive, not additive. I spend months, building this huge file of sort of every possible quote of any possible subject that I want to cover in the book. This book is pulled from, it's about 500 voices from the Manhattan Project and all sides of the World War II, including the so-called Hibakusa, the bomb-affected people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it's pulled from about 100 memoirs, a half dozen large-scale oral history projects by places like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and then, actually a lot of Nobel Prize lectures for this one. J. Robert Oppenheimer's 1,000-page transcript of his Atomic Energy Commission security hearing was a really useful primary source. And I sit down at the sort of start of the writing process, which is really a deleting process, with a document that is about 1.4 million words. And it's about 4,000 pages.
And the average long book is 200,000 words.
And then